I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Senator Rand Paul is not happy about the government's spending habits, but he is one of the few Republicans critical of the just-passed budget and tax plan that adds more red ink to the deficit. The White House is unveiling its infrastructure plan today, calling for $1.5 trillion in new spending. Now, not so long ago, most in the GOP railed against deficit spending and called for austerity for the government to live within its means. What happened? We asked Neil Irwin to join us. He's senior economics correspondent for the New York Times, where he writes for The Upshot. Also wrote a book called The Alchemists, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. Neil Irwin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So we're in this upside-down, topsy-turvy world where, as you said, the title of your story, liberals wanted fiscal stimulus, conservatives delivered it. What happened?
It's amazing what a little political power can do
exactly.
And how quickly things can change. So, the basic narrative of the last decade, we had a big recession, we had a horrible financial crisis, the Obama administration and Democratic Congress did fiscal stimulus, they did other steps to try and push more money into the economy, even at the cost of higher budget deficits. Republicans fought that tooth and nail. Since Republicans took control of the House and at the start of 2011, they successfully insisted on a series of measures to reduce deficits. Deficit has come down a lot from 10% of the economy in 2009 to about 3% last year. So those efforts worked. They did reduce deficits along with an improving economy. Now Republicans are in charge and they want to cut taxes and they want to abandon some of the kind of fiscal austerity that they had insisted on in the Obama years. The irony, of course, being that this is now in a time of a relatively healthy economy. We're now at 4% unemployment, 4.1, and they insist on budget cutting back when we were at 8-9%. So that's a strange irony, but here we are.
Well, does that just say it's just about who's in power and who's out of power and who's going to go after whom?
Yeah, we've seen a version of this out of the Republican Party for a while. In the Bush years, they cut taxes and they spent on prescription Medicare benefit and the Iraq War. So this is not unprecedented that,
right.
that Republicans are talk about deficits and fiscal austerity when they're out of power, but are inclined to spend when they're in power. It's kind of amazing just seeing how quickly the turnabout has happened in this last cycle.
So what is our debt for the year, and what is our debt for as you add up all these deficits? What is it?
So it looks like next year, the fiscal year that starts in October, the analysts are thinking it'll be about $1.2 trillion will be the deficit. In the last CBO forecast from last summer, before the tax bill, before the spending bill, the forecast was more like $700 billion. So that's essentially an extra half a trillion dollars in debt that the United States is likely to incur next year because of the combination of the tax and the spending bills. Now, of course, that could change depending on how the economy performs. It might be a little higher, a little lower, but that's the direction and the scale we're talking about.
Does that hurt the economy?
In the short run, it should help. It's very hard to pump an extra half a trillion dollars into the economy and not get some extra economic activity out of it. A lot of analysts are upgrading their forecasts. There's every reason to think 2018, maybe 2019 should be good years for the economy just because, everything's kind of firing on all cylinders. We were already at a fairly solid place, and now there's all this extra money coursing through the economy. The question is the medium and long term. So in the medium term, there's a real risk that instead of fueling higher growth and higher economic activity, this will just create inflation and higher interest rates, essentially crowding out other economic activity. Then in the long run, there's the risk that higher debt service payments, less flexibility to respond to future downturns, that's where the risk is in the longer term.
Does that explain what the stock market has been doing for the last week?
Yeah, I think what the stock market's doing is that medium-term story. So investors are kind of looking around and saying, well, gee, if the United States government's going to be issuing all this extra debt, that means there's going to be more bonds coming onto the market. Interest rates should be higher. And so we've seen that. The yields on U.S. Treasury bonds have risen. Interest rates are higher.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, you can look at the stock market drop as kind of the inverse of that and kind of a related phenomenon. Again, investors saying, well, we're now worried about higher interest rates out of the Federal Reserve. We're worried about higher inflation. That's going to make us readjust our expectations for what the next 2 or 3 years are going to look like.
Does the stock market get too much attention when we're talking about or trying to understand our economy?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the stock market's not a really useful. I mean, there's an old line that, you know, the stock market has predicted 9 out of the last 3 recessions. You know, if you think every time the stock market drops that, oh, we need to worry about a recession or an economic downturn, that's just wrong. An analogy I use is if you watch horse racing, if you go to the track, the underlying race is which horse comes in first and which comes in second and which comes in third. That's kind of the real economy. That's what we really care about. Then there's bettors betting on those horses. That's kind of like the bond market. So, if you look at treasury bonds, if you look at interest rates, that tends to be pretty directly connected to what's actually happening on the track, which horse wins and loses. It's about interest rates. It's about inflation. Stock market's more like this side game where people are betting on which bettor is going to do the best. It's kind of a couple of degrees removed. It's kind of erratic. It moves all over the place. So it's not telling you a lot about that underlying race. I think we do pay too much attention to the stock market.
I mean, more like a casino than anything else?
I mean, that's a little overstated. The stock market is an important vehicle for people who are doing long-term savings. It's an important vehicle for companies raising capital and having the capital they need to do business. So it's not as if it's a total abstraction. It's not gambling, but it is kind of just disconnected from what's happening in the real economy, which is the ability of people to have jobs and incomes and all that good stuff.
Here's an email from Sharon. This is about the tax cut. If the tax cut was reported to potentially raise the deficit by $1 trillion and the budget to raise it by $1 trillion, does that mean that the deficit is projected to increase by $2 trillion? I guess just doing the basic math here. Does that how it works, Neil?
Well, you have to, these are on different time horizons. So the $1 trillion revenue reduction of the tax bill, that's over 10 years. This spending bill is over 2 years, and that's $300 billion. And then there's all these dynamic effects where what happens to the economy will also affect how large the deficit is. All kinds of things affect that. What happens with interest rates? So if interest rates keep rising, the government has to pay more for debt service. So there are a lot of factors beyond just adding up those two numbers. The most reliable forecast I've seen, it looks like the fiscal 2019 fiscal year that starts October 1, we're looking at about an extra $500 billion in deficit spending.
That's Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent for The New York Times, the third of three guests on Radio Times today, talking about the budget, but also talking about the debt, the deficit, and what it all means. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Neil, let me pick up on something you said earlier, and I'm thinking of just an individual household. There's good debt and there's bad debt. I mean, in a good housing market, it makes sense to buy a house knowing that it will appreciate over time. There are probably things that you wouldn't want to buy because it doesn't really add to the value of your life or that house. Does that work when we're talking about the overall federal budget?
I think it does. I mean, as you're suggesting, as a household, if you borrow money for a college education, that's probably going to have long-term rewards. If you borrow money to pay for a vacation or just consumption, that's much riskier and can leave you in a bad spot. I think that the real dispute is which type of deficit spending is that long-term investment in the context of the federal government. So, I think a lot of people would argue that physical infrastructure, roads, bridges, water, electricity lines, that sort of thing, is the type of investment that has a long-term benefit. So deficit spending to pay for that type of stuff is perfectly fine because the economic benefits last for decades. Then you get into more disputable questions of, okay, is education spending and training for workers, is that in the same bucket? Is even some public welfare spending beneficial? If you're early childhood education, for example, if you're spending extra money to help, three-year-olds get have a safe place to go and a hot meal and some early childhood education, does that pay long-term benefits in terms of their economic output and productivity? That gets into some very ideological questions apart from the empirical questions. And then on the other side, for conservatives, so I think a lot of Republicans would argue that if you're raising the deficit by cutting corporate tax rates like they have, that will unleash faster growth in the future, that's mm-hmm. not a bad deficit to have because it's encouraging and incentivizing business expansion that will have long-term benefits from the economy. The principle that there's good debt and bad debt is definitely true. Which is good and which is bad can be in the eye of the beholder a little bit.
But if we are at what is called full employment today, does then adding to the deficit, does that, are there more people to be hired, or does that begin to show up in people's paychecks?
Well, this is a huge question, and I think it's the, you know, the most important question for the economy in the next year or two. You know, how much additional economic output can the United States achieve? We're at 4.1% unemployment. That's low by historical standards. How low can that fall? You know, can we get that down to 3%? How many people are not in the labor force and therefore don't count as part of the unemployment rate? But, you know, if wages start rising, if the economy is really, really hot, might jump back in and go to work. You know, these are questions we don't really know the answer to. So the more of that type of stuff happens, the more there really is growth potential, and everything will be fine. If there aren't that many people ready to jump back in the labor force, if there isn't higher productivity, if some of these good things don't happen, then we're just going to have inflation and higher interest rates, and that's not, you know, it's not really beneficial. It doesn't really show up in terms of higher quality of life or higher incomes.
And then the Fed steps in.
That's right. So if inflation starts to rise, you know, the Fed's been very gradually raising interest rates. They could move faster. And, you know, you can be sure if it looks like inflation's spiking above the 2% that they aim for, the Fed will raise rates and try and keep inflation stable.
So what
is that'll slow down the economy. That's essentially, in that case, they would be intentionally slowing down the economy to try and reduce inflation.
So what is our debt as a percentage of GDP? This is getting really wonky here, but you're the guy to ask, Neil Irwin. Go ahead.
We're around 80%. I mean, the question is where we're heading.
Right.
So 10 years from now or 9 years from now, 2027, you know, the forecasts from not that long ago, from last summer, had it rising to about 91% of GDP. If these tax cuts are fully implemented, it's 99%. So,
wow.
You know, that's a meaningful change. And what that means is we'll go into the next downturn, the next crisis, the next war, whatever it may be, in a more already financially extended. And so that's the risk. You know, going into the Iraq war, going into the 2008 financial crisis, we had much lower debt to GDP. That left policymakers with room to maneuver and room to, you know, if we're already at 100% and there's, a recession or a war, policymakers will be a little more wary of spending what it takes to deal with it.
And who do we owe all this money to?
I mean, it, all types of investors. You know, foreign governments are among them. China is a big holder, but, you know, so are a bunch of other countries. But also, you know, individuals, insurance companies, pensions, you know, university endowments. You know, the U.S. Treasury bonds are the deepest, most liquid market for assets in the world. So basically everyone in the world owns U.S. debt. And so we owe it both to ourselves and to people all over the place.
That's Neil Irwin, and he's senior economics correspondent for The New York Times, writes for The Upshot, and wrote a book called The Alchemists, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. And we are talking about debt and deficit and the U.S. economy. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. And I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Neil, you mentioned infrastructure spending, and the White House is offering a new infrastructure bill. I think 200, is it billion? I'm getting confused with all these big numbers. 200 billion coming from the feds, and the rest coming from the private sector and local jurisdictions and states as well. Do you anticipate this having some legs and getting support, and what kind of effect do you think that would have on the economy?
Well, so there's the substantive side and the political side, and I'm not a political handicapper, but I think it's very uncertain prospects in Congress.
Really?
I think a lot of Republicans are already not loving how much spending has increased on their watch. So there's some real wariness. We're already in an election year. Democrats who might be inclined to support something like this are going to be a little wary of giving Trump a win going into the 2018 elections. So you know, wearing a political prognosticator's hat, which is not my main job, I'm a little skeptical this will happen. If something did happen, there's then the substantive question. I mean, one issue with the way the Trump administration is approaching infrastructure is they seem very wary of just the blunt force of spending government money on projects. They want to do these complex kind of public-private partnerships, working with state governments, where they essentially try and pull both state and local money and private money into these projects, which, you know, is intriguing, and for certain types of projects can work really well. You know, one problem is it tends to favor things that, probably would get built anyway. So, you know, if you're talking about a toll road connecting to, you know, big cities, that sort of thing, it's easy to, you know, charge a toll and pay for it. If it's something that doesn't have a revenue stream attached, it gets much trickier, you know, just regular surface roads in a, town. You know, it also it will tend to favor richer areas as opposed to poorer areas. So if you think we need to invest in, some of the areas that have been left behind in the modern economy, that's not where private money wants to go. That's not the states that have the, capacity to, invest. So, you know, if this does become law, how much will it really move the dial on either the economy or, infrastructure? That's pretty uncertain at this point. A lot depends on the details.
Well, we have to leave it there. Neil Irwin, thank you so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Senior economics correspondent for the New York Times. And again, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, catching us all up on what happened in Washington, D.C., in Congress and the White House last week, and what's on the docket for this week and beyond. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.